in a situation where they also have returned income, which would be the range from $65 to no more than $320.
Thank you. Representative Hannah's staff is here. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Welcome.
For the record, my name is Bob Avery. I'm staff for Representative Bruce Hanna, and I'm here at his direction. Last session, when Representative Hanna first learned of the current SSDI offset of $65 a month, his first reaction was, this is simply wrong. It is a disincentive to work. And his remarks was in regard to the current situation, which allows people receiving SSDI to only keep a minimal portion of what they earn.
If you would speak in words rather than letters.
That's
okay. That's okay. That's fine. But I'm also going to say I forgot to ask people to take out your cell phones and your Blackberries, look at them, and turn them off. Not mute, but off. It affects the sound system. Thank you so much. And I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Thank you. So the ability to work and hold a job is important for a wide range of reasons. It's a path to economic independence, and it builds self-worth as well as contributing to the community. This ability to contribute and improve one's living situation is one of the fundamental rights that have made our nation great. And to have a state policy that discourages this is simply wrong. Having employed a wide range of people in the business world, Representative Hanna has seen how rewarding gainful employment can be to an individual's pride and dignity. Those with developmental disabilities deserve these same rewards. Our communities are also rewarded by the employment of these individuals, as they're an indispensable part of our community. The fiscal impact of this measure is small compared to the potential benefits to the people of Oregon. In his position as on the Ways and Means Committee, Representative Hanna has a unique understanding of our state budget and special insight into what this change in the offset will mean. Should the state be successful in its application for an amendment to the state's Social Security Disability Income Waiver, the net result should be minimal, and in fact may completely offset the impact as more people are given a direct incentive to work and earn more income. The overall results, however, will still be a greater show of respect towards people with developmental disabilities and an opportunity for them to have a greater sense of self-pride and dignity. And isn't that what we all want? On behalf of Representative Hanna, I urge you to move House Bill 2464 with a due pass recommendation. Thank you for your time and attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Avery. Any questions of Mr. Avery?
Thank you
so much, and thanks, Representative Hanna. And I think we have Brian DeLashmut, Catherine White, and Deanna Hartwick. Could you all come up at once? And I just want to remind you that microphones are very weird, so don't speak up too close to them. But welcome and thank you. Brian, do you want to go first?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian DeLashmut. I represent the Community Providers Association of Oregon on this issue. They are residential group homes that treat DD clients in Oregon. For them, this is not an issue of whether or not it impacts their bottom line. There are other issues in this session. But this is an issue that they bring to the table because they think it's the right thing to do. I do want to thank the chair for allowing the DD clients who were here earlier this week to go ahead and testify while they were here. We did lose one that had to go to work, but the four that did testify, hopefully they got their message across. It's don't take my money. I heard that over and over again. I hear that from my facilities, that these people have no incentive to work once they reach the $65. It really is an issue of two on two different levels. One is a disincentive to work for people that want to work. And the other is the independence and the dignity that comes from working. They want to work. But once they reach that $65 level, there is no incentive to work anymore, and they understand that. And so it's the state policy that we're really getting at here is, do we discourage people from working? Do we, in fact, allow them independence, the ability to grow and be productive citizens in the state? So with that, some of you, actually two of the members of this committee, the rest are all new, but we'll recall last session this bill was House Bill 3049. It did come in front of this committee. The chair was on the committee as a vice chair. We had some extensive testimony discussion about it. It went through three or four revisions to look in the design it is currently today. It went to the House floor and passed unanimously last session. And I guess the reason why it didn't get all the way through the system, obviously, was because of the economic times that we had. It got stuck in Ways and Means. Look at the economic downturn. We consider a very modest amount of money that this bill deals with. We were not able to find that, and we are very hopeful this time that we can, in fact, accomplish that goal. And with that, I do have written testimony that goes through some of the points that I talked about. But the real experts on this, actually my leader on this issue, is sitting right next to you. She's somebody that I rely very heavily on, and not only this issue, but also all DD issues.
Thank you, Mr. DeLashmet.
For the record, my name is Catherine White, and I work with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities and with the DD Coalition, which is an organization of approximately 26 organizations that represent providers, self-advocates, family members, and other advocacy organizations like the ARC and United Cerebral Palsy. This is an issue that we have talked about for over a decade. It has to do with some of it's partially state of Oregon, partially federal requirements. And that is a contribution to cost of care. And so what we are asking for is to allow people to keep their wages between 65 and 320%. The federal government has recognized that this is frequently a disincentive to employment, and has established a program called the Employed Persons with Disabilities Program that will allow people through a fairly complex process to maintain their wages if they make more than $320 a month. We're looking at the population of folks between the $65 and $320. And I want to make it clear that it is not simply keeping their money. People are expected to buy their own clothing, to buy all their toiletries, to buy transportation when it's used for recreation, any kind of recreational activity. So it is not simply just keeping the money, but it is also using that money to pay for some of their expenses. We find people paying for over-the-counter drugs out of the $65 that they're allowed to keep right now. As I said, this is something that we've worked on talked about for over a decade as being a major disincentive to employment. The Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities has in the last couple years renewed an effort to look at competitive employment for people with disabilities. We're engaged in some, some federal grants. There are groups of people working on increasing the employment and looking at the fact that we want to see everybody employed. This is a norm in our society, and it shouldn't be different for people with disabilities. This is a huge barrier to helping people understand the point and the purpose of employment. We feel that the actual fiscal on it is low enough that this really should be part of Oregon policy, and we encourage you to pass this legislation.
Thank you, Ms. White.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I may, actually, there's one additional point that I'd like to make. The question may be, how big is the population we're really talking about here? Anticipating that, I did write it down, but I forgot to mention it. In the category that we're talking about, between $65 and $320, it's estimated that that population is roughly 360 people in the state. So it's not every... Currently, yes. So the average that we're talking about as far as earnings is $280.
Okay, that's
so
helpful.
It's pretty reasonable, and it's a small population, but it's an important population to us. But in anticipation of that question, I forgot to mention that.
It's an important population to us. Thank you. Any questions of either of these two witnesses before we move to the next one? All right. Hello.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Deanna Hartwig. I'm the administrator of the Office of Federal Resource and Financial Eligibility, Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services, and I'm here today
to talk. Susan, can you hear her all right?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
As you've heard, individuals who are working are allowed to keep the first $65 of their income, and they are required to contribute the rest of it towards the cost of care. This is a federal requirement for individuals receiving services under a home and community-based waiver, which these individuals are. They are in our comprehensive services waiver for people with developmental disabilities. So in order for us to accomplish this bill, we would have to receive a waiver amendment. The bill acknowledges that the department would need to seek one. However, it's unclear to us, the way the bill is currently written, if we would be required to implement these changes prior to receiving an approval of our waiver amendment, which would allow us to use federal funds to make up the difference in the cost of care and services to providers. The department has developed fiscal impact for this. It's on the second part of the testimony on the back page. For example, in September 2006, people with disabilities paid a total of $134,386 for the cost of services. If we increase that retention of income to $320, they would have paid $86,550. The state would have paid the difference. So using this baseline data, the state would incur a $1,004,556 loss of revenue in the 2007-2009 biennium and a loss of $1,148,064 in the 2009-2011 biennium. In order for us to get federal funds to match that difference, we would need to get an approved waiver amendment from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, who have the ultimate authority to approve those waiver documents. To reiterate something that Catherine was saying about people with developmental disabilities and their eligibility for the Employed Persons with Disabilities program. As a comparison, back in September 2004, we had 14 individuals in that category. Today, we have 82. So we have moved to put people in that program, which allows them not only to retain more of their income, it allows them to have a higher resource limit than the standard $2,000 that Medicaid allows. Again, it's a case-by-case, person-by-person process, and it does not alleviate the concerns that they have mentioned for the broader group of people in order to have a fix that accomplishes an ability for them to retain their earnings as well. But since it does have an impact that was not anticipated or included in the governor's budget, the department is opposing the bill.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Gelser.
I have a couple of questions. Is that
okay? Yes.
Thank you. We heard testimony the other day that there were individuals that were actually needing to pay more in the offset than what it is that they had earned, and I wondered if the three of you might be able to address what it is that would cause an individual to have to pay more than they were actually making back to the state.
Well, I'm not sure about that particular circumstance, but there are individuals who have unearned income benefit, typically coming from the Social Security Administration. Some of the individuals have supplemental security income. Some individuals have Social Security benefit. So I'm not sure the situation for this individual, but let's assume they're someone with a Social Security benefit. Any of their unearned income above the Social Security or the supplemental security income standard also goes to cost of care. So an individual that has, say, $800 in Social Security benefit would have a room and board amount to pay of approximately $460-some. They also retain $141 of that for personal spending. And if they're working, they get to keep the first $65. So it may be that between that $141 from their unearned income and $65 from earnings, by the time they make their service contribution, they are short in paying for their other incurred medical that they're allowed, maybe the Part D drugs. Those should be coming off the top of the service contribution. So I'm not sure what this person meant when they said they paid more in than they made.
Catherine White. Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, I believe that one of the examples that we had seen in the past had to do with the fact that the individual is also taxed on their earnings. And so when you factored in the taxes that they paid on their earnings, they ended up coming in a hole and not being able to keep the money. They ended up paying out more than they were actually getting between their offset payment and their taxes. And we can get back to you with the detail on that.
Madam Chair, if I may, that was the case 2 years ago in the testimony. That was the example that was given.
Thank you. Another question, please?
Yes.
Thank you. For other individuals that don't have developmental disabilities that are receiving services from other parts of the state, maybe TANF or food stamps or Oregon Health Plan Plus, are there similar $65 per month limitations on what they are able to keep of their earnings before they need to pay into those benefits that they're supporting with their tax dollars?
This requirement is specific for people on home and community-based waiver services. We do have a home and community-based waiver for aged and physically disabled individuals. They have that same requirement to contribute anything above $65 of their earnings to the cost of care. This bill does not include that particular population.
Follow up.
I
think I wasn't clear in the question.
Could you bring the microphone a little bit closer? Thanks.
If you take it out of this particular circumstance and look at policy statewide in terms of individuals that receive services from the department, I'm wondering what level for people that aren't on a home and community-based waiver or who aren't disabled that may be earning money in the marketplace but are receiving services from the state, do we have similar limitations on non-disabled people for how much money they are allowed to keep before they make a contribution to their state services?
Representative Gelser, I'd have to defer to Children as Adults and Families to answer that question. I can only speak to the senior people with disabilities population. I can't answer the question because I don't know.
All right. And I could
follow up.
Thank you. How long would it take to apply for and receive the waiver that you discussed previously?
The preparation for the waiver itself is probably a matter of several weeks. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has 90 days to review, approve, deny, or ask for additional information. And they typically take the full time, so it would be a minimum of 90 days to maybe 120 days.
And follow up?
Follow up.
Has the department, given that this bill has come up in several sessions before, has the department attempted to write a letter to apply for this waiver, knowing that this is an issue that's brewing?
Representative Gelser, we have not. However, I did have a preliminary conversation with our state representatives who are in the Seattle Regional Office. And the only thing they could tell me is send up your information, we'll be happy to look at it. They weren't able to really advise one way or the other as to whether they would accept an amendment that put forth this particular option.
Have other states been successful at receiving this waiver?
Representative Gelser, other states run their programs so differently that it's hard to look at a national comparison. Some might have higher income maintenance standards that allow people to keep more money in their hands. Some people might be more successful at utilizing the Employed Persons with Disabilities program. We haven't, frankly, done a comparison. We are following up on a couple of the states that were mentioned, I think, on Wednesday to see if there's something unique in how they're operating their waivered services, which is the rural service that we're interested in here, and successfully gotten approval from Centers for Medicare and Medicaid to allow this kind of retention. If that's the case, we can certainly model our waiver request after theirs, which would, you think, allow a greater chance of successful approval.
So 2 years ago, when this bill had passed on the floor and went to Ways and Means, as I recall, is that correct? So at that point, you didn't look into this waiver
Chair Tomei, at that time we were hopeful that our employee persons with disability program would at least, since that is a state plan eligibility option unrelated to the specific home and community-based waiver requirements, that might be a venue for a broader group of people with disabilities who are earning wages to retain more of their income. As Brian mentioned, that program doesn't at this point reach as many people as could benefit. We are looking at changes in that program as well to see if we can capture people with earnings more in the category that has been brought to your attention today. I don't know how that will progress, however.
Thank you. And Brian, so I saw you nodding your head that other states are doing this. Can you tell us about what other states do and what states that is?
Madam Chair, again for the record, Brian DeLeischmidt. In casual conversations, and I cannot document specific states, but in communications, including states like Minnesota, in which some of our in Oregon people have had communications, either because our former president of our association actually is now in Minnesota, came from Minnesota, and had called to see how they handled it. It is different. Each state seems to be a little different. Even though there is a federal requirement, each state has a different kind of a waiver. And to be quite frank, in our conversations behind the scenes with other states, they actually were kind of surprised that Oregon hadn't taken advantage of some amendment to the waiver to pick up this category of clients. So Minnesota is one state, but two years ago we did make some calls from other states, and I'd have to resurrect my file on those other states. But Minnesota is one example.
Thank you. I understand you want a question.
No, actually, Madam Chair, I just want to inject this here. Looking at the House bill and everything, I see that it declares an emergency passage and kind of supports a little bit, I think, where Representative Gelser is wanting to go with this. It's declares an emergency. I like this concept. I like this bill. And I just want to throw this out there for maybe some discussion later on. Maybe doing something different to give Department of Human Services an opportunity to move on this immediately, rather than it being an emergency passage, you know, to identify a date later on in the future for it. I just, you know, throwing that out there.
Representative Gelser, do you want to respond to that idea?
Sure. I'm pleased to be a co-sponsor of this bill with Representative Hannah, and I think that it could make sense to submit an amendment that directs the department to apply for the waiver within 30 days of passage of the bill and to implement the program as soon as the waiver is received.
Okay, I've just realized that we should not be discussing this, and we should do this in the work session. That was my mistake, not yours. I asked you for your response. Okay, I had a thought here, and now I've lost it. Does anybody else have any more questions? Representative,
I have one last question. I'm noticing in the fiscal, when you talk about the fiscal cost of this, it speaks to it as revenue. And I'm wondering, in terms of thinking about how much programs cost, is the fiscal impact because it costs more to administer this, or is it simply that we are taking less money from these people, and therefore there's less money coming in?
Representative Gelser, it is the latter. If the individuals are not contributing this to the cost of care, that cost would shift to the state and hopefully federal funds to make up the difference. This is money they pay directly to their provider. It doesn't add additional. We set a service rate. Part of it comes from the client contribution. Part of it comes from state and federal funds under the waiver.
Madam Chair, if I may actually respond to that answer. The second piece of that, however, that we feel has been, and there may not be any way that they can estimate what additional revenue could be generated, but if you have an incentive for people to work and you have more people working and more people go above the 320, you may in fact generate some revenue as well in offsets. And I understand they can't estimate that, but you know, that's one of the things that we've been thinking about all along is you encourage people to work, you encourage people to be productive citizens and pay their taxes. In this case, they would be paying the money above 320 instead of 65. And so you may get some offset on that.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Go ahead.
Sure. Representative Cowan and then Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. DeLeischmidt, in the comments that you just made, it
kind of keyed something for me. I was kind of flipping through some of the testimony that we heard from individuals at the last hearing. I earn $290 a month. I earn about $130 a month, et cetera. Is that the amount of money that the clients would keep if they were qualified under this waiver, or is that actually, do you have any idea if that's total earnings a month or if that's just the portion that's in question? I didn't mean to put you on the spot from other testimony, but maybe you guys could give me an answer, one of you.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowley, yes, that would be total earnings that individuals would be bringing home, and that would be the amount that they would be allowed to keep. But again, I want to stress they're also paying for things like clothing and other incidentals out of that amount of money. But that is their total income.
Madam Sheriff, I may actually respond. We've had cases in some of the group homes that I represent in which someone needs a new pair of tennis shoes. And because they're only able to keep $65 and they need a pair of jeans and a shirt and they need tennis shoes or toothpaste, that the staff kicks in to help. And these are staff that are making just barely above minimum wage because they know that that Kyle or Ross needs a pair of tennis shoes.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you all for being here. I echo Representative Olson's comments. I think this is a good bill, and I'm behind it. And I continue to be amazed by our colleague, Representative Gelzer, who first of all showed us in a magnificent hearing about what we could do with waivers. What was the name of that? What was the number of that bill?
2406 and 2407.
And now this one, and this one particularly is interesting to me because she's doing a better job of communicating the philosophy of my party than we are. But I'm specifically interested because of my background a long time ago in sort of being an intermediary between the federal government and state issues. It's Ms. Hartwick, right?
Correct.
I don't expect you to answer for the entire administration, but you're here. And I guess what my question that I'll eventually get to is what's it going to take, you think, to get the your department and the governor on board on this? Do we need to help you with liaison between, could, for instance, our congressional delegation be of help? I don't really know, sorry to say, what offices there are between the governor and the federal government to advocate this. And lastly, do you anticipate a situation where you would offer an amendment that would satisfy the concerns that you have in your testimony?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, we will absolutely have to request an amendment to our existing home and community-based waiver in order to implement this bill in whatever form it comes to the department. It is not unusual for us to do waiver amendments throughout the course of a waiver. They're typically good for 5 years. We're pretty experienced at doing this. The question will be, when the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid look at this, does it fit with the requirements for the waiver around eligibility and post-eligibility treatment of income? If they can find that it does meet those requirements, they would have no reason, I would hope, to deny us the waiver amendment.
Thank you.
Let me add, that's if you want federal funds to help make up the difference.
Seeing no further questions, thank you.
Thank you,
Brian,
for your attention this morning.
Oh, thank you all for coming. Thank you very much. I'm going to open up a work set, close the public hearing and open up a work session so we can discuss this. So I close a public hearing on House, unless, oh, was there somebody, I'm sorry, was there somebody else who wished to speak on this? Okay. I'm closing a work session or a hearing, public hearing on House Bill 2464 and opening up a work session on House Bill 2464. We have LFO coming sometime this morning, and so what I intend to do is close whatever we're doing and let them speak in a work session about the fiscal ramifications here. I think we're all Andy's trying to tell me something. They'll be bringing a written fiscal that we can look at. I think, are all of us wanting to see this move along?
Absolutely. But I'd like to make a comment in the work session piece.
Sure.
My feeling is, I guess I'm disappointed that the governor didn't include it in his budget, and because this is, you know, as Representative Gilliam suggested, that Representative Gelser is asking for something that I think we all believe in. It's not a party issue. Is that we want people to work, and we want to give them those incentives to work. And when we as government disincentivize people to work, then we're creating harm. And so I applaud Representative Gelser and Representative Hanna for continuing this march, and I just hope the Ways and Means folks will see to it that it may not have a physical impact, because we'll get more people to work because they want to work. So I just had to make that comment, and thank you.
And I appreciate that. My fear is that we can approve this unanimously, send it to the floor, and it can be approved very unanimously and can go down to Ways and Means and die. And that's not what I'm hoping to see happen. So I'm hoping we can do something with this so that it does not go to Ways and Means and die. And, you know, we put the department at a disadvantage. We put the Ways and Means committees at a disadvantage. I mean, there's only so much money, and we need to deal with what we've got. So we're going to work hard on this, and we may not get this out today. We may not get it out next week. But my intent is to work on this with Representative Hanna and Representative Gelser and the rest of you to see what we can do to move this along. So when LFO shows up, we will hear from them to see what they're saying about the fiscal. And we'll
sorry.
Go ahead.
LFO.
Legislative Fiscal Office. I'm sorry, other people not to speak in letters,
well,
and here I'm doing that.
Letters. Okay, so.
Any other discussion on this?
That's fine.
All right, I will close the work session on House Bill 2464, and I am going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2195, and I really wish that Andy were here to tell us, but since he's not, I'm going to read what it says. House Bill 2195 provides clarification regarding the respective roles and responsibilities of caseworkers and law enforcement personnel in making determinations about when and how to take a child into custody. Current statutes allow child welfare caseworkers, law enforcement, and others to remove a child when a child is in danger because of abuse and neglect. This measure provides greater detail in statute as to when child welfare workers should collaborate with law enforcement and or seek a protective order from the court for child removal for child abuse or neglect reasons. And it amends ORS 419B.115 and contains a series of criteria and requirements governing the child custody process. So we have several people who want to speak on 2195, Una Swanson and Kevin Campbell. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Una Swanson. I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services. And I appreciate this opportunity to bring this discussion to the committee. As Chair Tomei said, House Bill 2195 was forwarded by the Governor's Office at the request of the Department of Human Services to provide clarification for our caseworkers around their role and responsibility in making decisions about the removal of children from their parents due to abuse and neglect. We see this as one of our most critical decisions. Prior to this session, the department convened a work group, and that work group included members of law enforcement, the judicial department, the Juvenile Rights Project, and others, to discuss this issue, to gain feedback on our role and responsibility, our public accountability as child welfare in making these decisions. I'd like to say to the committee that a strong recommendation from that work group at the time that we convened was that we pursue this particular discussion and this particular issue through a training solution as an alternative to legislation. The department continued to believe that they needed further role clarification and did move this bill forward. But I'm very pleased today to say that the department is here with the tremendous support of law enforcement, and Kevin Campbell will speak to that in just a moment. And we believe at this point that we can pursue a training solution that would include specific clarification around the role and responsibility of law enforcement and caseworkers in making these important decisions whenever we need to remove children. And at this time, we would like to say to the committee that we believe that we can pursue this process as an alternative to moving the legislation further. We'll work on plans to develop this training out of the existing resources we have, and at some point in the future identify if there's a fiscal impact to supporting this training in the way that we want to see it happen. Thank you, and I'm available as a resource to the committee if there are questions.
Thank you. Why don't we hear from Mr. Campbell, and then we'll see if there are questions.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm with the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and serve as their executive director. This morning, I'm also authorized to share with the committee on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon State Police, and the Portland Police Bureau. And it's pleasing to me to be able to come to the committee today, along with DHS, having forged a cooperative agreement. It's been interesting. Just over the last few years, we've had the opportunity to interact. I've had a chance to be on a couple work groups with UNA and their folks, and in each case, we've been able to come forward to the legislature and let you know that we've been able to figure it out on our own in a way that we believe serves the public. And that's really what it's all about. When law enforcement and DHS get together, the people at stake are the public, and in particular children in crisis, and that's what really matters when it all comes down to it. What we found, and in the task force discussions, is that these are charged situations in every case, and law enforcement and DHS caseworkers live in two different worlds often, and yet they come together for a very important purpose and have to work together out in the field to make some very important decisions. We want to make sure that our folks are properly trained. I've been excited to talk about training over the last few years. In 1997, we had just 8 weeks of basic training required for our police officers. That changed in 1997. It took all this time, actually, until earlier this year to go to the new 16-week training standard, which occurred with the completion of the new Public Safety Academy. That's significant, but what I think is even more significant about the training we're delivering today is that we've gone now to what we call a scenario-based training, which integrates a large number of policies and components and gives the officer the chance to confront situations that they're likely to confront in the street. And we see a potential here in terms of creating training opportunities for DHS caseworkers and law enforcement working together in scenarios, which we're very excited about. We are very committed, and the purpose for me being here this morning is to commit law enforcement to this training objective, that we believe that the answer to some of the stress that we find in the field really comes down to a training deficit between DHS caseworkers and law enforcement personnel. And so I'm here on behalf of all those groups to make a commitment before the committee and a commitment to DHS that we are fully behind that, and we will actually also sit at the table with DHS to the degree that there is a fiscal for this kind of training. We will sit alongside DHS and advocate for this. We think it's very important. When I look at the law enforcement challenges we face right now, many of them are addressed through training. The more training we get, the safer the public is, and when children in crisis are the point, it makes it particularly important for both DHS and law enforcement to work together. So I want to thank the committee, and I want to thank DHS for our opportunity to work together, work through another challenge, and be able to come together as a cooperative entity to move forward for the public safety. So with that, Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I want to thank you.
You're very welcome. And any questions? These two folks? So my understanding is that if there is a fiscal, that we might be hearing from you again. Other than that, you're going to be taking care of the concerns that were addressed in this bill. Is that correct?
Thank you, Chair DeMay. That's correct.
And if there is a fiscal, you'll be coming back to us, and then we'll have to go down to Ways and Means. Am I correct there?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, at this point in time, we'll be looking at our resources to provide this training should in the future that happen. I'm not anticipating that during this session.
Good.
I have one question.
Yes, I
answer.
Yeah.
I know earlier in the year you mentioned to me the other day that DPSST did sponsor some training, some joint training there. How long was that?
Chair Tomei and Representative Olson, yeah, I don't have a lot of detail. It was in January.
Uh-huh.
This was the first of many, and I think that we are, this is probably one example of the type of training that needs to be offered, but I don't think we're limiting ourselves to one type of training, and we're just starting to introduce it. But it was held in January. It's the kind of thing that we're going to create more and more opportunities around. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Gelser is in line before you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank both of you. I know that a tremendous amount of work and conversation has gone into making this work, and I know that both law enforcement and the department are very committed to Oregon's kids, and thank you for taking the initiative and finding a way to make this work together.
Thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a quick question for either Ms. Swanson or Officer Campbell. Can you just give us a quick thumbnail on this in terms of what are we looking at in terms of either calls that could result in the kind of training that we need or actually taking children in Oregon into custody?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, are you wondering how many children are taken into protective custody
yes.
in the state of Oregon?
In addition to how many calls that could potentially, or at least there are initially, trying to address that kind of a custody situation.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, I apologize. First of all, I don't have that number in my head, but I know when we researched this, we knew that about 60% currently of the times that child welfare was in a position to take children into protective custody, they had law enforcement beside them. And there are other times when we take children into protective custody when we're in a setting such as a hospital or maybe we have a court order or we're in a school setting. But a lot of what we were looking at in the language, the draft language, was reflective of what the practice is now.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you so much. Thank you for working together and coming out with a good solution for all of us.
Great. Thank you so much.
Children of Oregon, you're welcome. So I'm closing the public hearing, unless anybody else wishes to speak. Seeing no one, closing the public hearing on House Bill 2195. Okay. Let's see. Next is House Bill 2182. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2182. This bill would allow the Department of Human Services to reimburse relative foster parents at the same rate as non-relative foster parents, and it authorizes the Department of Human Services to consider income and resources available to relative foster parents in determining the need for or amount of foster care payment. It authorizes the foster care payments to for-profit child caring agencies. And we have several people who would like to speak on this. I'm going to call up three at one time, Kevin George, Samuel Henry, and Mickey Lansing. Speak in the same order in which you signed up. So that would be Kevin, Mr. George, Mr. Henry, and Ms. Lansing.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Kevin George, and I am the foster care program manager at the Department of Human Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you about House Bill 2182 that we have brought forth through the governor's office in a recommended budget package as well. What I'm here to talk about today is in this bill, we have three distinct concepts that are played out. And in the written testimony that I provided to you, what I'll do is try to highlight just the pieces of it, not read it to you. But the first piece of the bill actually allows us, by it expands the current Oregon statute to define foster parents as a wider group of folks and not limiting it to non-relatives, which is what it does right now. Currently, we have a problem in Oregon where we are not able to pay relatives who we place children with unless those children are eligible for federal funding. So as the last presenters got up here and talked about, once there's a decision to remove children from their home, they go somewhere. We try to place children with relatives as a preference and as often as we can. And in doing so, then, we have to look at being able to provide federal fund or foster care funding to that family. But the current statute prohibits us from providing it to all relatives, only those relatives that are caring for children that are eligible for federal funding. The next piece, then, is really looking at, almost going back to Mr. Representative Gillum's question last session, was we have 7,734 children who actually are in foster care today. So we're talking about quite a few children that are in foster care today. 30% of those are actually placed with a relative. And of all those children, we're able to provide assistance to 75% of them. So we're talking about that 25% of the children placed with relatives are not able to get foster care funding at this point in time. The statute is one where it has been an historic change since 1979. There were federal legislation that started requiring foster care funding to go to children eligible. Oregon has complied with that, but it has not required states to use general fund dollars. The majority of states around this country actually do provide relative care funding for relatives. Oregon and California are the only two states that have not been doing that at this point in time. The second clause in our bill goes into the piece of asking for the legislative authority to create administrative rules, meaning that we would request that we have the authority to create administrative rules that would provide a means test for relatives. So what we would be doing, in essence, was to take, if we're placing a child with the grandmother, the uncle, the aunt, is actually assess their financial income. And if they fell below a poverty level, which we're looking at right now is about 150% of poverty level, we would say we will compensate that family. Those that do not demonstrate a financial need, we would not pay for them as well. The third component in the bill, and before I move on to that, within that means test, what we've calculated is it's approximately $2.6 million general fund for this next biennium. We looked at a startup date of July 1st of 2008, and we would then place the means test in at that point in time. The third component of this bill gets into clarifying some federal language. The law has changed in the federal government in the last 2 years to allow 4E dollars, federal Title 4E dollars, to be able to go to for-profit, nonprofit agencies. And the Oregon law right now just continues to say nonprofit. So this is just clarifying the law to allow us to provide foster care funding through private agencies, if so needed, for-profit agencies as well. So it's clarifying federal regulations. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. I thank you for your time in listening to this bill and our support of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. George. Any questions? Representative Gelser and then Representative. Oh, Representative, what is his name?
Maurer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How did you arrive at the level of 150% of FPL for a family to receive reimbursement?
Representative Tomei, Representative Gelser, what we were trying to do is establish some way we could actually measure that. And as we started looking at funding to say, is it 100%, is it 150, is it 200%, trying to come up with what would be a ballpark number. And so we literally just went down and started saying what would be a reasonable amount of funds that we would say that the relative has. And so it really was just a projection out there to say 150% translates into around $19,000 a year. It's still a low amount of money, but it is one where we try to put a benchmark or a level there at this point. The statute actually allows us to craft rules around that. It doesn't put in 150% in the statute itself, so it will allow us to craft rules, and if we're able to provide any sort of flexibility, we'd be able to do so. But at this point in time, we've identified for budget purposes 150% of poverty level.
Okay. When do I remember correctly that previously there were family foster payments, or there were payments made to relative foster providers?
Representative Gelser, there is currently payments to relatives, but the way that the law shifts is that we are only able to pay those relatives foster care funds if that child they're caring for is eligible for the federal funding. So of the 2,000 kids we place with relatives, 75% of those children are eligible for the federal funding. Therefore, we're required and we can pass that money on. It's the last 25% that we're prohibited from federal law to be able to provide because they're not eligible for federal funding. So most states provide that last 25% of the kids with state funds, which is what we're coming forward to ask here.
Okay, thank you. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Actually, that was specifically the question I had. I still am confused with the numbers. So just to say 7,500 children, and 30% of those reside with relatives, correct?
Correct.
And then 75% of that 30% already receive the supplements, or
correct?
So that means, I guess I'm trying to, the family situation in this case is the family the child lives with is a family not eligible. But the foster parent is a lower income. Is that my...
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, you're absolutely right. This is one of those, how does this work? When a child is actually placed into foster care, what we are determining is the child from what the home that they were removed from, and this is all the federal regulations. If they were removed from a family that met poverty levels or that was eligible for welfare at that point in time and some other conditions, then that child is determined 4E eligible for funding. And if we place that child with a stranger or with a relative, we're able then to pass those funds on. If the child is not eligible for federal funding, the federal rules stop and state rules start up and to say, how do we pay? And so our current statute does not allow us to pay that relative unless they are 4E eligible. So what we do at that point, and this bill would contemplate, is then we turn from looking at the child and their eligibility through the parent to now turning to look at the relative and say, do you have financial means to care for this, your grandson or your nephew? If not, the state then would come in and provide that same level of foster care funding.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
And then the other thing, and it wasn't in your test or your written testimony, is that Oregon and California are the only states that don't have this bill or the language in this bill in there?
Correct. Representative Maurer, Oregon and California are kind of the last two holdouts on moving towards paying relatives to care for kids. And the argument continues to be, are you paying them? Are you reimbursing them? The reality is we reimburse foster parents at a rate of somewhere between $14 to $16 per day for a child. So my kids certainly eat that much in a day at my house, so it's one of those, is it reimbursement or payment? So it's only Oregon and California at this point in time are the only holdouts that are not paying relatives.
May I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Gillian.
The main reason that foster relatives may not be eligible is financial?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gillian, exactly. What we'd be looking at is the financial means. Now, all other conditions still apply, that we still do safety background checks, criminal background checks. They're required to do training. They have the same level of requirements as any other foster parent, the difference being we haven't been able to pay them to care for that child at this point. So it is about finances only.
Any other questions? Thank you. I can't remember who was next. Mr. Henry.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Samuel D. Henry. I'm the chair of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, a voluntary citizen position. My day job on your other payroll is as a professor of education in the Graduate School of Education at Portland State University. I also come before you as Antonia Edsilla's father. I think she's in third period now. She's 15 years old and in high school. You may ask, why do I bring that up? Because there are three levels of what I would like to respond to today. Our Commission on Children and Families is about several things. One of the most important is the latter that I mentioned about kids. The next level is about our local commissions, and the other level is about a system. And so I would have you imagine, if you would, three levels of response to our issues in our communities and in our state, and three levels of what we would like to see happen via this and other pieces of legislation. There are a number of states that are considering similar kinds of legislation around foster care. And my colleagues here can probably give you the names of those states. It comes in the context as we begin to look and see what are the issues and what are the gaps and what can we do to address the gaps in taking care of children and families. And also it's part of an international, and that is something too that I think is quite exciting. Foster care became a part of our legislative agenda at the Commission on Children and Families because more than 18 different local commissions said to us, there's a problem here. And I want to emphasize that only because I, as a citizen, as a dad, as a participant in our society as a citizen, realize that most of the decisions about larger policy are made at a level that doesn't always consult with local citizens. And I want to emphasize that point because our local citizens, with all due respect, are not D's or R's or I's for the most part. They sometimes are, you know, if the Gallup poll guy asks them directly. But for the most part, they're ordinary people who would like to have some solutions and hopefully through our social contract as government. But that's one of my classes and I won't go there. Our agenda emerged from local plans. It's been raised at the state level. We've discussed the state level. You've heard from one of my colleagues. You're about to hear from another about some of the issues that are important to us. We stand firmly behind this legislation, this piece of legislation. We support it. It is a part of other parts that need to happen on behalf of our society. My daughter, hopefully again in third period. When you have a 15-year-old, that's always a hopeful thing that's going on. Although it's not her pattern, it can happen. When we think about what it takes emerging into adulthood, and yes, she's learning to drive and some other kinds of things that scare the heck out of me, but as we think about that and we think about what policy addresses what the needs are on the individual level, we have some issues that this is a part of, and foster care and what happens to kids in foster care, because these are my daughter's peers, what happens to kids in foster care is very important to us. And I'm not presuming that it's not important to you. But this constitutes a critical piece because this is a part, a step toward the family connection with foster care. We know that one of the critical issues is that many kids get into foster care. They lose the connection with their families. As soon as they exit from foster care, they end up trying to reconnect with their families, and all too frequently, they are unable to reconnect with their families, and they connect with sometimes the worst elements in our society. This is a piece, as we imagine it, of our policy working toward creating that kind of envelopment for kids in foster care. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Henry. Any questions of Mr. Henry? Thank you very much. Ms. Lansing.
For the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families.
Ms. Lansing, may I? There you go. That's better. Thank you.
My voice is too strong.
No, it's not your voice. It's these darn microphones.
Thank you. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, as Chair Henry said, the State Commission looked at 36 local plans from local communities who said, here are our most pressing issues. Those plans come to us as a commission. We have a multi-agency group that looks at them and says, what are those things that we need to focus on and do something about? What has come to the top of our priority list is the fact that kids are being abused and neglected every day. The foster care system has become overwhelming. We continue to need more and more foster care homes. And what is it we can do about that? We asked Dr. Catherine Kahn from the Portland State University Child Welfare Partnership, who trains all of the child protective service workers in the state, to write an issue brief for us about foster care. We sat down with Dr. Kahn, and she said to us, Mickey, the issue is not more foster care homes. We can never build our way out of this issue. The issue, number one, is how do you keep children safe in their own home? And we need to provide those early supports, those supports all along the continuum to ensure that that occurs. So when families get into problems very early on, where are the community supports that can intervene at that point? However, if we can't do that, the best place for a child is with kin. Research has shown to us that if children are placed with safe kin, and I accentuate the safe part of that, that their outcomes are much better. Their biological family is willing to get help many times. They're more open to that kind of intervention. The children return to that family sooner. If that's not possible, those children who are with extended family have that connection, and they have better outcomes as adults. We do have research that shows that. We believe from both a policy and a population perspective, Oregon's children sit dangerously in the middle of a collision course set first by changing demographics, limited public funding, and the increasing developmental needs of children who are being placed in foster care. The fixes we have available present at best only a partial and limited solution. So we believe that a powerful voice is needed to ensure that we have a full range of supports and that where possible, children can be placed with safe kin. I also want to bring up the issue of children and youth of color. What we know, research shows, is that there is a particular shortage of foster care homes for children of color and children whose primary language is not English, with a particular need for Spanish and Russian-speaking homes. As we look at all of our systems across the continuum, prenatal to 18, 21, 24 years of age, every one of those systems has a disproportionality of children and youth of color. And this is an issue that we really have to focus on. I want to say to you that we are completely in support of the policy change of being able to pay relatives or kin to provide foster care. At this point, with Oregon's policy, we really force children to live with strangers. One of the things that you hear, especially from adolescents and teenagers, is the only thing they really want is to feel normal. That can occur when those children have some kind of a family connection. Thank you. Any questions you might have?
Thank you, Ms.
Lansing.
Representative?
Thank you, Mickey. I got a question for you. I truly appreciate the times over the past years from previous experience having a foster care home to be able to bring someone there and the quality that I felt that existed. I think we've had this conversation before, but what is happening? And it seems like we are seeing less and less people being involved with foster care homes, and that is an issue and is a concern.
Chair Tomei? Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, Department of Human Services may be able to answer this question better than I, but I do know that, you know, remember, it now requires, economics now require for two people to work. We are in a different society today, and there's a piece I have given you that gives you a little bit of that background. And our system is based on many years ago, really, where one parent worked outside the home, the other parent stayed inside the home. That's one issue. Children and youth have much more severe problems today than they did in the past. Much more severe. So that takes extra help. One of the things we haven't talked about this morning is the support that current foster care people need. Those foster care parents spend much of their life trying to care for children for very little return because those children are in the system. That's another piece that we need to look at. I don't know, Kevin, if you want to respond to that.
Hey, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, again, Kevin George for the record. Ms. Lansing did an eloquent job of explaining that. And I also want to make sure, though, that, too, we don't sell ourselves short on the fact that we have families each and every day stepping up in the state of Oregon to provide foster care. And the fact is we actually have more foster parents this year than we did last year, more than the year before, and the year before that. Problem is that the number of children keep growing at a faster rate, and that therein lies our problem. It also lies the problem of trying to say the preference, both in statute, practice, and research, is that how do we really get relatives and keep relatives engaged and be able to provide kids? Because quite honestly, that is part of the solution. A big part of the solution is keep kids engaged with their relatives, place with relatives, and staying within family as much as possible.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. You had talked previously about studies showing that kids do better when they're placed with biological relatives. And I was noticing here that a foster parent who is a relative as defined by rule. And I wanted to be sure if a child is adopted, that relative by rule, that would be the family related to that adoptive family tree, correct? Not going back in time to the biological family tree.
Yes, Chair Tomei, Representative Gelsert, correct, right. At that point in time, it's the legal parent, so it is the adoptive parent that we're talking about in terms of child that happened to been that happens to be adopted. We are looking for their grandparents, not their biological ones, after the legal relationship has been severed.
Okay. So just a quick follow-up. So in those studies about biological kin, it's not so much the biology, but I'm just wanting to clarify what I heard. It's the family structure of a child growing up in a family that knows and loves them. It's the family relationship rather than the biology. Is that correct?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, I would venture to say that most of the studies out there that talk about familial relationship and the positive outcomes for children are not as specific or as honed in to say about are adoptive children any more likely to have a stable upbringing if they're with their relatives versus non. Most of the studies that are out there, again, child welfare, quite honestly, in the scope of time being fairly new, and research is still pretty limited in some areas, I don't think it's delved into that specific niche of it more so than relatives in general.
Chair Tomei, if I may respond on the professor side in terms of some of the research. The research is looking at social systems, and the social system is either the adopted family social system or the biological family social system. The social system itself is what is the support and is what my colleagues have referred to is what is needed and what is fairly, at least as we study humans and primates, fairly natural part of this piece of coming to maturity and of realizing oneself within a society.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Representative Maurer.
I'm sorry.
Give you a hard time today.
Much of this discussion is really beyond the scope of this legislation. Am I correct in that wording? I mean, because you've touched on a lot of topics that fall outside of this in general terms. Am I correct in that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, the piece about changing the policy. Right now, Oregon has a policy that you cannot pay relative foster care if they are not 4E eligible. So they need to be.
Okay. So, this is another broad sweep of the whole context about we build systems as a function of how we pay for them. And so this really gets to a piece of if we can change how we pay for something, the system will mold itself around that and hopefully will encourage more people to end up with relatives than we will with non-relatives, and so it's better. And so, in the healthcare debate, we're having the same thing, is we build these systems, but how we pay for it. And so, it kind of gets back to follow the dollars.
Is there a question in this
room? No, there isn't. I am naive when it comes to foster care, and this is a very interesting argument, and I need to go back and read this paper because it's quite long, but this is very interesting and very supportive. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Chair Tomei, can I just add one other thing that is occurring right now is that the Commission and the Department of Human Services have entered into a partnership whereby we have a consultant who has been consulting with states all over the nation on how you find family for children that can be placed with that family, and it's called Family Find. And right now we have 14 counties with teams from each of those counties in the belief that the community supports the work of the Department of Human Services in helping them. Their role is to find that safe parent, that out-of-home placement. But our role in the community is to support them in doing that particular job. So a fellow by the name of Kevin Campbell, not the one you saw prior sitting here, nor not the Kevin Campbell from Eastern Oregon, but Kevin Campbell is a consultant who has developed a methodology of finding family. And so in the past, where children have come into custody and needed to be placed, and some search has been done, he is able to show people how to search, where the average is they find about 40 family members and then start the process of seeing which one of those members would be willing to take this child in foster care. And so we are almost at the end of those trainings. What we have done for the first part of that is focus on youth who are 16 years of age or older, have been in the foster care system at least 18 to 24 months, and will be transitioning out of that system to ensure that they have a family connection as they transition into adulthood. And what we know about those youth is approximately 25% of them become homeless. And so when we talk about all of these systems, you have to, one system affects another, affects another, affects another. So again, we have to look at this as a continuum, prenatal to 21 to 24 years of age. What are the supports that need to be in place in communities, and how is it that we work together, both as state agencies and then with our local partners who actually provide those services?
And thank you so much, Ms. Lansing. It might be appropriate sometime for Ms. Lansing and others to have a public information hearing on the foster care system. That might be appropriate. Maybe we could look into that in the future, because it sounds like you have a lot of information that would be helpful for us to have. And I know Representative Gilliam has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just parenthetically to Representative Maurer, if you eventually get to a question, the chair tends to remember your name.
I do want to ask a specific question and get back to this bill, just so I understand it. I'm sure it's partly me. And I can't help but digress one more time to Professor Henry and say that I understand, I feel your pain, because I have a 17-year-old on a rotary exchange in Brazil. Ooh. And there's a 5-hour difference. Is she in third period right now, or is she at the beach? I don't know. So I'm with you. On the numbers, if we pass this, we are encouraging, I know we're not saying that we're recruiting new families, but we're encouraging a number of extended families, safe kin, by giving them full payments and support.
how many families are we encouraging or even recruiting by passing this bill?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, what we're actually doing, in essence, of encouraging more is what we're really trying to do is knock down the barriers too. So at times we actually have relatives that can step forward, but for financial reasons they can't take the child in. You've got grandmother and grandpa, potentially a single grandma working. She's 55 years old, still working. All of a sudden now has got Johnny. Now what does she do about daycare? What does she do about? So at times it's not so much encouraging new, but it's really knocking the barriers down. As Ms. Lansing has talked about, there's a number of barriers to relative placements, and what we're trying to do is attack each of these simultaneously to hopefully increase that level. So what we're looking at this point in time is currently, if I went out and counted, I always get in trouble, but if I went out and counted noses today, I'd have about 460 children in a non-paid status. We project over the next biennium that to grow to about 530 children. And so if we say 80% based on this budget would qualify for this, that is another 300 to 400 children that actually would be covered in that. So if those children are one per relative, two per relative, we're looking at substantial numbers of changes.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Good question. Any other questions? Thank you very much, panel. We have a couple of other speakers, Mark McKechnie and Amy Miller. I just want to remind you not to speak too closely into the microphone. Mark, since you signed up first, you want to go first?
Thank you. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the legislative chair for the Oregon chapter of the National Association of Social Workers, and I'm here on our organization's behalf. We represent about 1,700 social workers in the state of Oregon. This is a very crucial issue, and I appreciate you holding this hearing today. I also want to recognize that this issue has been brought forth in basically every legislative session in my memory, often by legislators, family members themselves, advocates. But this time around, this issue has been brought forth by DHS and the governor's office, and I want to give them credit for doing that. With that said, however, I think you appreciate from your discussion with the first panel how complex the situation would remain under the changes in House Bill 2182, because it would not result in paying all relatives who are providing foster care. It would further, it would pay some additional relatives, but still leave some relative foster parents behind and likely prevent some children from being placed with relatives as a result. And you heard a lot about the benefits of relative foster care from the first panel, but I would also add that some of the specific benefits for children placed with relatives also include that they are less likely to move from foster home to foster home. And that's a very, very vexing problem in the foster care system are the children who end up moving from home to home to home. And it has a snowball effect for them as they experience rejection, whether they're being rejected or not. I mean, as Mr. George talked about, it's hard to recruit and retain foster parents, and some foster parents decide to leave foster care for various reasons unrelated to the children they're caring for, but they have their own children, they have to move, jobs change, all sorts of things happen. So nationally, the average tenure for non-relative foster parents is about 2 years providing foster care. So it's very significant that relative foster care provides more stability for the children in those homes. There are all sorts of costs down the road that can result when those children move around from home to home to home in terms of higher needs for mental health care, very expensive treatment services, placement in settings that are much, much more expensive than foster care. And then if you extend that further down the road, you may look at homeless teens and youth who penetrate the juvenile justice system and the criminal justice system later on. So those are also important things to keep in mind. Also specifically, an Illinois study found that when children are placed with relatives, they're a third more likely to leave foster care successfully by either being reunited with their parents, being adopted, or being placed in permanent guardianships. So it's a way to reduce the length of stay in foster care and ultimately reduce the number of children in our foster care system. So fundamentally, NASW supports the change in on page 1, line 25. We're very concerned about subsection 2 of section 1, which is lines 13 through 16, which creates a mechanism for the means test that you were discussing with the first panel. This further distinguishes between the haves and have-nots in the foster care system. The benefits of relative foster care are significant enough that it's a wise investment to pay all relatives. And we also know that relatives who provide foster care as a group are significantly lower income than other foster families. The DHS estimates were that about 56% of current relative foster providers would fall below the 150% of poverty, which is quite low income. And then the remaining 44% would be somewhat above that. But all of the foster homes in their sample had household incomes below 300% of poverty, which is not, these are not wealthy families we're talking about, and they will still struggle to provide for the needs of the children who are placed with them. Eliminating the means test from this bill would mean that we would have a much more clear system where every family providing foster care would be paid. And from the point of view of an individual caseworker who's trying to find a placement for a child, often they need to find a bed for that child to sleep in that night when they're looking. They would simply be able to tell that those relatives that they would be reimbursed for the care of the child at the standard foster care rate that Oregon pays. Currently, caseworkers are told, it's emphasized to them, never, never, never promise a relative a foster care payment because they have to go through this process of looking at the child's FORE eligibility first before they decide that that relative could be paid or not. With subsection 2 and section 1 of this bill, they would still have to do that. And they would say, well, and once we determine whether the child's FORE eligible or not, if they're not FORE eligible, then we're going to look at your income, and based on our current rules, we're going to decide whether we can pay you or not. And I know that even under the current FORE system, the delay in determining FORE eligibility can mean a delay to the relative providing foster care of weeks or a couple months. So where even though they will eventually be reimbursed, they're bearing the cost of caring for the child while that determination is being made. So NASW strongly encourages this committee to pass 2182 with the change in line 25, but we strongly encourage you to consider removing lines 13 through 16 and removing the means test from this bill. And that would result in a much fairer and less complex, straightforward system for both the relatives and the child welfare professionals who are trying to do what's best for kids in the foster care system. And with that, I think I will end my remarks and turn it over to Ms. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. McKechnie. Any questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you so much for allowing me to be here today. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Amy Miller. I'm a staff attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, which is a law firm that represents and advocates for children and families in Oregon. More specifically, we represent several thousand children and youth involved in the child welfare and juvenile justice system by court appointment each year. We have provided testimony and technical assistance to committees and members of the legislature in every year since our inception, 1976. We support the concepts behind HB 2182, which eliminate the statutory distinction between relative and non-relative foster parents. We applaud DHS and the governor's office for making efforts to eliminate this distinction and to support relative foster parents. Unfortunately, we have to testify in opposition to this bill. The reason for our opposition is that this bill will establish a means test for relative foster parents, so those with incomes over 150% of the federal poverty level still will not be eligible for foster care support payments. This means test is an inefficient use of public resources. All of our data, both local and national, shows that most relatives caring for children in foster care are low income. In Oregon, the majority of our relative caregivers are older, oftentimes single, and have one income. DHS looked at a sample of current relative foster parents who are not currently receiving foster care funds, and every family in that sample had a household income at or below 300% of the FPL. 68% of these families in the sample had incomes below 200% of the FPL. It doesn't make sense to create additional eligibility parameters when we know that nearly all of these caregivers need our assistance. We also know that relative foster care is good for children, and you've heard a little bit about this already. Research shows children in relative foster care have better outcomes than those in non-relative care. Children placed with relatives are more likely to stay put in one place. In Oregon, 14% of children in foster care experience three or more placements in the first 12 months. Children placed with relatives are more likely to leave foster care successfully to either reunify with their parents or moved into an adoptive or permanent guardianship situation. Because relative foster care is good for children, it makes no sense to put some relative foster parents at a disadvantage. In addition, we need our relative foster parents. We're facing a shortage of foster homes, and the number of children in foster care is expected to grow 12.1% from the last biennium to this current biennium. Relative foster parents provide a critical and needed service and should be treated fairly and equally in the same manner as non-relative foster parents. Relative foster care is also cost-effective. The DHS program costs for foster care are about $13,000 annually. The program costs for adoption assistance and subsidized guardianship are about half of that. We should be encouraging relative foster care because not only is it better for children, it reduces costs. Senate Bill 282, which is proposed by the Juvenile Rights Project, puts relative foster parents on equal footing. We support foster care payments for all certified relative foster parents. And the appendix, which is a graph that you have to my testimony, shows the differences between HB 2182 and JRP's bill, Senate Bill 282. HB 2182 creates yet another eligibility distinction, while Senate Bill 282 ensures all foster parents receive support to assist them in covering the cost of raising these children. Relative foster care is a good investment. The state should make this investment and assist children and their families in this process. Thank you for giving me the time to speak to you today. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Either of these witnesses? All right. Thank you very much.
No.
I'm sorry, Representative Maurer.
No, I didn't bring a calculator. So what are the number, I'm sorry, question, what are the number of families that we're talking about? And I'm trying to do the math of 75%, 30% of 7,700 and 75% of those already are eligible. So we're talking a number that's not very big in the total scheme of things. Would that be a general assessment?
Yes, from Mr. George's testimony, it sounds like a couple hundred families. The difference between establishing a means test and not having a means test would make the difference between whether a couple hundred additional families would receive foster care support.
And if I may add to that, currently, so just from Mr. George's testimony, about 1 in 4 children who are placed with relatives are placed in homes where the relatives don't receive payments. The DHS proposal would make that number be 1 in 8, so that 1 of 8 children placed with relatives would not be eligible for payments. What we would advocate for is that every child who's placed with a relative that's licensed and certified would be in a home where those payments are made.
Thank you. Representative Callan.
Thank you, sorry,
were you through, Representative Maurer?
My only question, it's really not to this, it's to DHS, did they accommodate the administrative effort that has to be put forth in their calculation how much this is going to cost the state?
And maybe we can ask DHS to provide that for us. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think actually my questions or comments sort of play off of Representative Maurer's question. To put all of this in simple English so that I make sure that I understand it, and I'm kind of thinking about the public perception. I suspect that the public perception is that when a child needs to go to foster care, the family with whom that child is placed might be biological, might be a family member, and it might be a non-family member foster care provider, but that there is a financial support system for foster care providers. I suspect that the general public doesn't really realize that there's a difference in whether you're related to the child or not, whether you have financial support. So if I understand it correctly, your request is that we simply make it one and the same, that anyone who provides foster care gets the financial assistance for that foster care. And if I'm looking at the reading the pie chart graph, which is always helpful to me to have it in graph form, we'd ultimately be talking about perhaps 3% of children who are in the foster care system who would currently then, or under the this bill, House Bill 2182, would not be receiving that support for the foster family. So I guess ultimately I'd like to ask these folks if my understanding is correct, and then secondly ask for some fiscal impact information on what the cost would be if we extended it to that additional 3%. So is that number right?
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan. Yes, ma'am, you have a correct understanding, so that there would be still about 3% of the children who are placed with relative foster parents those foster parents would not be eligible to receive payments. That is correct. As far as the fiscal impact goes,
I wasn't asking that you have to present okay. that. I guess I should do this more formally. Follow-up, ma'am.
Follow-up.
Madam Chair, could we ask that the representatives from the Department of Human Services bring us back a little information on what the fiscal impact would be of adding this 3% of children?
Yes, we could do that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And the department is here. Mr. Cerise is here. I don't need to do anything more formal than that, do I? No. If you could provide that for us, Mr. Cerise, it to the administrative staff who will give it to all of us. Thank you. Any other questions of this panel? Thank you very much for testifying.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? If not, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2182, and we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2073.
Thank you for bearing with
me. I think there's somebody here from the Department of Housing and Community Services. And I don't see anybody standing up. Oh, there he is. Great. Oh, should we do something with you
Thank
first?
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 2073 is a measure that would rename the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger, and the new name would be the Interagency Council on Hunger and Homelessness. It would also expand the membership of that council, and it would also modify and expand membership of the Hunger Relief Task Force.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you for appearing today.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Again, and I wasn't sure if you wanted me to go through the bill again.
I don't think so. All we need is for you to talk about the amendment.
Madam Chair, there are essentially three amendments. Again, for the record, Rick Crager, Deputy Director, Oregon Housing and Community Services. Three amendments that we have to the bill. The first one is essentially to Legislative Council thought we needed to rearrange the language to make it a little more clear in terms of the Hunger Relief Task Force responsibility versus Interagency Coordinating Council. So that was the first that's mentioned on lines 1 through 7 of the amendments that you have. The second amendment is on lines 8 and 9 of your amendments. Basically, we had neglected to put a key piece of the federal definition of food insecurity into the original bill. So this modifies that, and that's again on lines 8 and 9 of the amendment. And then lines 10 through 12 is essentially to place a benchmark in terms of where we want to be by the year 2015. In the original bill, as you may recall, it just said in food insecurity, we felt that there needed to be more of a benchmark to at least be within the top 10 states in terms of food security. So those are essentially the three amendments that we have. We don't see any major changes to the initial bill.
Thank you. And I just want to point out that we got a notice this morning that there is no expenditure impact. So we're not looking at a fiscal nor a referral to Ways and Means. So any questions on the amendments? Do you remember we had a hearing on this? Any question on the amendment?
Just a comment on the amendment, on the second portion of that. In any socially acceptable way, or that's in the eye of the beholder, isn't it, for how much...
Here's a question.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I move House Bill 2073 be amended with the dash one amendments.
Representative Maurer moves that House Bill 2073 with the dash one amendments to House Bill 212073 be accepted. Any questions? Any concerns? Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Hearing none. Representative Maurer?
Madam Chair, I move the committee recommend rescinding the subsequent referral on House Bill 2073-1. And
Go ahead.
And that we send it to the floor with a do pass recommendation as amended.
See if I can remember all that. Representative Maurer recommends that the the committee rescind the subsequent referral on House Bill 2073 to Ways and Means, and that we send it to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
As amended.
As amended. Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So now, or was that the motion that I should take roll? Okay, we'll take a roll on that. Thank you, Andy.
Representative
Kellen?
Aye.
Representative
Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Kochak?
Excused.
Representative
Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Chair
Tomei? Aye. Okay. House Bill 2073 as amended has been, and rescinding the subsequent referral has been rescinding to the floor with the due pass recommendation. As amended. So there we go. And I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2073. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. Representative Greenlich has proposed a 10:30 in the morning joint meeting next Friday on the 16th for the House bills on pharmaceutical gifting. And traditionally, that period between 10 and 12 in the morning is to be left open for these kinds of joint hearings. So I'm hoping that all of you will be able to make that. Is there a problem with that?
I'm sure glad that you shared that was traditional, because traditionally I hold it for everything else.
I know we do, but the speaker has asked that we keep that for special things that he is encouraging us to do.
That was February 16th.
Is that correct?
That's what my staff will get from today.
Okay.
That's good.
Okay. Any other business that the committee should be dealing with?
Are we still going to the beach?
Yes, we are intending to go to Lincoln City on the 2nd. However, I have a call into the Senate office to make sure that the hearing will be in the morning because at least Representative Gelser has a commitment in the afternoon. So I'm hoping that it will be in the morning. So, but I will get back to you on that. Representative Callan.
Just, Madam Chair, just for clarity, that our committee meeting is hopefully meeting in the morning.
That's
and
what
then
I'm
the emergency preparedness meeting is meeting in the afternoon. We're not trying to meet jointly.
We are trying
committee.
To meet jointly to talk about the public health portion of that. What
in the morning and then extending
the,
whatever the rest of that committee wants to talk about into the afternoon.
Indeed,
that
that's what I'm hoping to do. But I've gotten sort of mixed messages from the Senate office. So
I'm getting some mixed messages as well. And I'm trying to. And I think more specifically than my question that was put to me by some of the local folks in Lincoln City was whether they are supposed to be finding, suggesting invitees. Suggesting individuals who should be specifically invited, are they responsible for that or are we? And I'm probably just showing my ignorance as to how these things work at this point, but I'd like to give my local folks some direction.
Absolutely, and I hope that we can clarify that today sometime with Senator Berger's office so we can figure out what time it is and what each of us needs to do to prepare for that.
So if anything is being asked of me or any communication to my local people that I should be making, I will assume that I'll be notified.
That is a great assumption, and I hope it's accurate. Representative Gelser.
Back to the meeting on the 16th. Will we be holding our regular Human Services and Women's Wellness meeting from 8:30 to 10 and then coming back at 10:30 on that day?
On
next Friday, the
16th. No, that will be our meeting.
Okay, so no meeting, so that 8:30 time.
Correct.
No, okay, I didn't understand that.
I didn't either, and I'm so glad you said that.
Thank you.
And is dress casual at your house after the beach meeting?
Dress is always casual at my house.
We don't have a carrier for 2073. I don't need to go back into the work session, to do that?
I'm not positive.
Well, we're not going to. So would anyone like to carry that? Anyone volunteer to carry that?
Well, I actually think you should give it to Representative Maurer.
Yeah. We could vote. Let's have a voice vote.
Then you better open a work session.
Sure. No, I'd be happy to carry it.
Thank you, Representative. I would appreciate that. Okay. Any other business? All right. I'm closing the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. Thanks to all of you.
So we're
thanks
meeting
to our
right.
Pardon?
We're meeting.